I was the one who suggested a getaway, a week in the woods. We both loved to hike, and the colors of the autumn leaves upstate were said to be spectacular this year. Hey folks, greetings and salutations, how you doing? This is Keith Tyler, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. A real treat to have you with me, thanks for tuning in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Andrew Clavin bring us our first story. It's called A Long Time Till Morning. Were we unhappy? No, that's not the word I'd use. Melinda and I had always had a solid marriage. We both worked hard at our jobs, too hard sometimes, but we made good money, lived well, and enjoyed the finer things in life. Good food, good wine, travel, friends, the arts. We had never felt the urge to have children. We enjoyed our freedom too much, but we had our dogs, two lovable, raucous Irish setters, Sparks and Willie, and we lavished our parental attentions on them and took great satisfaction in our long weekend walks, the four of us together. It was after the dogs passed, first Willie, then Sparks, that I began to sense a certain, a certain emptiness between Melinda and me, as if each of us had retreated somehow from the shared territory of married life and withdrawn into a private space of our own. Oh, no, there was no unfriendliness or irritability. We didn't quarrel or carp at one another. Well, the opposite, really. We became polite and careful. Over coffee, at dinner, in bed. Like strangers on a long plane flight who had too much to do with too much time seated too close together and are trying our best to keep things civilized. I was the one who suggested a getaway, a weekend in the woods. We both loved to hike, and the colors of the autumn leaves upstate were said to be spectacular this year. We did one of our elaborate and expert online searches and finally settled on renting a renovated hunting lodge on a forest hilltop above the river. Miles of walking trails, fabulous views. Then, a stroke of bad luck. 2 weeks before we were scheduled to leave the city, Melinda was carrying a bag of trash out of our townhouse. She came off the last step of the stoop and landed wrong, sprained her ankle. Oh, her foot swelled up to the size of a suitcase. The doctor told her it would take months to heal. She would have to wear a hiking boot. Hiking was out of the question. I wanted to call the trip off, but Melinda said no. She said it would still be good for us to get away. I could walk in the morning, and she would stay in the lodge and read and quilt. We would still have evenings together, wine by the fire. It would be a nice break, she said. We decided to take that Friday off and drove our SUV into the village of Weston Lake on the Thursday afternoon. It was a quaint and pretty place. Brick storefronts along Main Street, a steeple church on a grassy lane, hills of pastel forest rising against every horizon. We had brought groceries from the city, but were reassured to see a gourmet market and a wine shop near the heart of the village. Apparently, we hadn't left civilization altogether. Well, now, why are the flags at half-mast? Melinda wondered. I mentally ran through the usual atrocities in the news, but couldn't come up with anything out of the ordinary. Well, must be some local thing, I said. It was, in fact. We asked the landlady about it when we stopped off at her house to pick up the keys to the lodge. She was a large, friendly woman in her 50s, June Myers. A big, hospitable personality with a ready laugh, but sad eyes. At least, I thought so. She had her own house away from town, a two-story clapboard on a hillside with views of the woods and a little sparkly patch of river in the distance. It was musty inside. There were photographs of family, married children, grandchildren, on all the tabletops and mantelpieces. A wall calendar from a local church with reminders scribbled in the Sunday squares. But to me, the place felt lonely and deserted somehow. Through one doorway, I saw a man's den with leather furniture and a gun cabinet and a stag's head mounted on the wall. But I knew instinctively the man himself was gone. Dead, probably. The room preserved as a memorial. Melinda asked about the half-mast flags.
That's for the McLaughlins, June said with a sorrowful sigh. Such a nice couple. Such a tragedy. They had a big old house up on the cliffs, 3 children of their own, and then they took in foster children. Sometimes they had 10 kids up there all at once. Anyway, about a week ago, I guess it's a little more now, in the dead of the night, there was an explosion. Probably a boiler blowing up. That's what John, the fire chief, said. But they're really not sure. Anyway, the house caught fire. A whole section of the cliff gave way. The earth and the flaming debris all spilled down the side of the mountain. With everyone inside, they still haven't found all the bodies.
Oh, my God, said Melinda. That's awful. Oh, yeah, I just read about that, I murmured. It had just come back to me. One of those sensational stories that makes the national news for a day or two, then slips away in the general clamor of meaningless nightmares near and far. My eyes had passed over a paragraph about it on some site or another. Melinda and I drove on, up the mountainside, into the woods. The paved roads became dirt roads under the wheels of our SUV. Well, that wasn't the cheeriest story to start our vacation with, I said. It's so horrible, said Melinda. She was in the passenger seat, gazing out the window at the woods. The late sun streamed through the branches out there. The yellow, red, and orange leaves tumbled through the air to the earth. It was too beautiful to comprehend. I could see it, but I couldn't fully take it in. I reached over and gave Melinda's leg an encouraging squeeze. She took hold of my hand. We smiled reassuringly at one another. We seemed to be as we always were. I could not have said that made me feel so alone. The lodge was everything we could have asked for. Rustic, well, rustic looking, but equipped with all the modern conveniences. Central heat, a gaslit fireplace complete with remotes, full internet and cell phone service. A huge kitchen fully appointed, enormous windows wide as the walls, high as the ceilings, with vast views of the forest, the river, and the sky. Oh, it's perfect, said Melinda. I helped her limp inside and sternly commanded her to sit still and rest while I brought in the luggage and groceries. A lot of good that did me. She hobbled off into the kitchen and set about filling the refrigerator and the cabinets with food and wine. It was already getting dark, too late to go walking. We had a glass of wine together in front of the living room fireplace. We gazed out the windows and watched the sun set behind the pastel trees. After a while, Melinda thumped around the kitchen in her walking boot, fixing dinner while I unpacked our clothes in the master bedroom upstairs. Finally, we went to bed and made love carefully, so as to not hurt her foot. Then we lay together in the forest darkness and the forest silence all around us. "It's so quiet," Melinda whispered.
I listened to her breathing change as she drifted off to sleep. For the life of me, I could not imagine why we were losing each other. The morning was crisp and cold. The autumn woods were a little paradise of loveliness. I left Melinda on the sofa with a mug of coffee and her e-reader, and I went off hiking. The trail led upward from the driveway through the gently wind-blown trees. The climb peaked at the ridge that looked out over the countless miles of forested hills with the broad, slow, snaking river directly below, reflecting the shimmering colors. Lost in dreams and contemplation, I became exhilarated and forgot my troubles. I walked vigorously for, maybe half an hour or so, a little more. Then came to a lofty lookout rock. I pulled myself up and stood on the flat stone, taking in the vista. The woods were silent behind me, except for the breeze, and the creaking of waving branches and the whisper of fallen leaves skittering across the ground. Then, suddenly, as startling as a gunshot, a twig snapped behind me. Startled, my heart racing, I spun to see who was there. Just below me, where I stood on the stone, the woods stood still and empty. The breezes lifted and hissed, and the leaves rattled. And almost imperceptible among those sounds, I thought I heard, a child's mischievous giggle. I caught my breath. I called out, "Hello? Who's there?" The only answer was a dash and a scramble through unseen leaves. A squirrel, or a deer maybe, racing away. Or a child. It could have been a child. After that, nothing but the wind again. I knew I was alone. I stood on the high rock and panned my eyes across the face of the forest. I don't know why my breath came quickly, but it did. Then it caught. I had seen something, a blue light, down in the distance, visible for only a second, then gone. Was it the flasher of a police car? Was it moving toward our lodge? I did not know what else it could have been. My stomach clenched with fear. I told myself it was nothing, some glitch of my imagination, but at the same time, I started back along the trail, not running exactly, but walking at high speed, breaking into a jog sometime. When I came down the hill and saw the blue and yellow sheriff's department car parked in our driveway behind our SUV, my insides turned to acid. Why was I panicking like this? What was I thinking? What was I afraid of? I didn't know, but I was afraid, that was for sure. I hurried up the porch stairs to the front door, stepped inside. A veteran deputy, a trim, silver-haired man in his 40s, was standing in the living room. When he turned toward me, I saw Melinda behind him. She was sitting on the sofa, right where I'd left her. She smiled at me. She was fine. "What's going on?" I said. Here's what she told me. After I'd left for my hike, Melinda sat reading on the sofa. She had a fire going in the fireplace, a mug of herbal tea, and a novel she liked. She was content, appreciating the quiet and the time off from our busy lives. About half an hour passed like that. Then she heard something. She lifted her eyes to the window. She listened. Someone? A child. Was crying just outside. It was no easy thing for her to stand up. She had taken her boot off and had piled some cushions on the coffee table so she could elevate her foot as the doctor had instructed. It took her a good minute or so and some real effort to get the boot on and to work herself out of the sofa. The crying continued as she limped to the door. The child was now sobbing miserably. As she opened the door and looked out, a little boy sat at the base of an oak tree just beyond the drive. His arms were crossed on his raised knees, his face buried in his arms. His jeans and his shirt were disheveled and torn. He had no coat on. He must be cold, thought Melinda. She was reluctant to try to get down the porch stairs on her own. She called to him, "Sweetheart, are you okay? What's the matter? Come here. Come here to me." She had to call to him several times, but finally he raised his sad little face to her. "Come on," she said. "It's okay. Come over here." The forlorn, bedraggled creature climbed laboriously to his feet. He shuffled across the grass to her, sniffling. His head hung. His face was so pale, it seemed nearly gray. His eyes were large and hollow. He couldn't have been more than, 7 or 8, she thought. Her heart ached with pity at the sight of him. "What's the matter, sweetie? Are you lost?" He nodded, sobbing. "Well, where are your people? Where's your mom and dad?" He could only shake his head as he dragged his fist across his runny nose. "Okay, all right," said Melinda. "Well, come inside now, and I'll give you something to eat. Are you hungry?" "I'll give you something to eat, and we'll call somebody to help you." She took the waif by the shoulders and gently guided him into the kitchen. She questioned him as she made a plate of butter and bread and some slices of ham with a glass of milk she used for her tea. But the boy only cried and shook his head. "I got lost," he told her at one point. And when she asked his name, he said plaintively, "Robbie." That's all he would tell her. She left him eating hungrily and hobbled into the living room to call the sheriff's office. "Well, I thought of that house," she told the dispatcher, "the one that burned down with all the children in it. But he wouldn't talk to me. If he's a survivor, he might be in shock." When she returned to the kitchen, she found the boy slowly chewing his bread and staring into space. His cheeks were streaked with fresh tears. "Oh, now don't worry. Someone is coming to help us," she told him. She stroked his hair, but he just went on chewing, staring. She sat with him at the kitchen table until she saw the blue light of the patrol car and heard its tires crunching the dirt of the driveway. She pushed out of her chair and made her clumsy way to the front door to greet the deputy as he came toward her. I can't get anything out of him," she said as she led him across the living room. But when they came into the kitchen, the boy was gone. The only trace of him was a bit of meat left on his plate, a finger of milk in his glass. The deputy went out the back door and searched the tree line. Both he and Melinda called the boy's name, but there was no answer. No sign. I had planned to speak to Melinda that night, about us, I mean, about this feeling I had that there was distance between us, that we were losing each other in some way. I couldn't quite describe or explain. But as we sat there together on the sofa in front of the living room fireplace, each with a glass of wine, it was difficult to talk about anything beside the boy. I told her about my experience on the Lookout Rock, that giggle I'd heard and the sound of something or someone running away through the woods. "Do you think some of the children could have survived that house fire?" she asked. Maybe they're in shock, you know, wandering around, lost." Melinda had a habit of inventing stories to explain things she didn't understand. What the couple across the restaurant was talking about, or why a homeless man was muttering about the moon. Maybe it was this or that, she'd say. Sometimes she'd come up with a whole narrative about them. My own mind tended to be more logical and fact-based. What I didn't know, I didn't know, and I would say so, and that was that. I shrugged. It's possible, I guess, I said. I have no idea, really. Well, it's unsettling, though, isn't it? I find it unsettling. Yeah. Yes, it is. I feel that way, too. Somehow I couldn't find a path from this conversation to the one about our relationship. I decided to wait for a better opportunity. I carried our empty glasses into the kitchen and set them in the sink. I was moving to return to the living room and help Melinda upstairs when I noticed something. I paused, hearing my pulse beat in the silence. There was a fashionable knife block on the counter to the right of me, an expensive collection of German cutlery, 11 blades in all, each with a slot of its own. But there were only 10 knives there now. One slot was empty, one blade missing. The large chef's knife, by the look of it. I checked the dishwasher, but the knife wasn't there either. Had it been there when we arrived? Had the collection been complete? Or was one blade missing even then? I hadn't noticed. I didn't know. I couldn't remember. I decided not to mention it to Melinda. I wasn't sure why. The idea that the boy might have stolen it made me faintly ill, and I saw no reason to disturb her. Not in the dead of night, anyway. Still, I lay awake for a long time after we went to bed. I could hear the forest outside. I could hear the wind when it moved through the branches. At one point, I sat up in bed and listened. I thought I heard voices whispering. A giggle? Very soft. Hard to be sure of it over Melinda's gentle snoring. After a while, I convinced myself it was only the fallen leaves chasing each other across the ground. I did not want to leave Melinda in the morning. "You can't just sit inside all day," she told me. "No, I won't. I'll just hang around a while and make sure everything's okay." "It's fine. If he comes back, I'll just call the deputy again. It's no big thing." I nodded. I did not tell her about the knife. I felt foolish, entertaining crazy fears, unnameable anxieties. We sat together at the kitchen table, I with my mug of coffee, she with her tea. "Can I ask you something?" I said after a while. "Is everything all right between us?" I think I was hoping she would say, "Well, yes, of course. Why do you ask? Right away, you know, as if she hadn't noticed anything." It would have been so much easier that way, but she didn't say anything at first. She looked out the window, thinking it over. I watched her profile. I remembered how beautiful she was when we were first together, how I could barely stop making love to her. And, of course, you move beyond that at some point. You're not young forever. Still, you become something else over time. A marriage, one flesh, as the Bible says. I did not want to consider the possibility that we were no longer feeling that way about one another. "I miss the dogs," Melinda said, turning to me. "You know, I really miss them." I nodded. "Sure, I miss them too. They were great. We could get some more. We should." But she shook her head. "I don't know. The thought depresses me somehow. I'm not sure why." "Well, maybe it's too soon. Maybe we just need more time to get over them," I said. "Maybe then we could get some more." After that, well, we sat without speaking. I tried to think of something to add, something upbeat, something reassuring. About all the good things we still had in our lives. It was strange, though. Nothing came to me. Or, that is, everything I thought of felt like ashes just then. The day went quietly by. Melinda was right. I couldn't just hang around the place. She wanted to sit by herself and quilt. I tried to read, but found I couldn't focus. My mind was on the forest at the windows. Eventually, I went for a hike. It was another lovely autumn day. Blue sky through the high branches, painted leaves. Oh, the air so alive, it seemed to walk with me like a companion. But as much as I tried to still my mind and enjoy the walk, I was on edge. I was anxious and strangely wary. My eyes searched the woods around me. For what? Some figure watching from the tangle of branches? Some child with bright eyes and a malevolent smile? Was the danger real, or was it a projection of my own imagination? As before, I climbed toward the ridge. My mind returned to my talk with Melinda. It was one of these conversations where you feel that certain words are being said, but the meaning they convey is entirely different. "I miss the dogs," she said. But what was she trying to tell me? I worried it was something dark and awful, something we had to face but couldn't. What was it? I didn't know. I lifted my eyes from the leaf-blanketed trail. I saw the lookout rock ahead and above me. Something tightened inside me with fear as I approached it. My footsteps slowed. I did not want to go up there again, but I did not want to be a coward either. My phone buzzed. It gave me an excuse to stop, to look around me, to search the depths of the forest. With my eyes as I fished the phone out of my pants pocket, I glanced down at the readout. To my surprise, it was June Myers calling our landlady. I answered it. June, hi. There's no answer, but I sensed that someone was on the line. The silence was somehow alive. Hello? I said. The answer was a hoarse, harsh, stuttering breath, a whisper. June's voice. Hurry! June, hello? The silence went dead. Then a tone. The correction was broken. The fear I felt already, and the sound of that hoarse voice, that strange, sinister message, it all combined to ignite in me, and I was suddenly running. I could not run the whole way, but even as my breath grew short, I stumbled and jogged forward as fast as I could. I reached the lodge. I hurried inside, calling Melinda's name as I came through the door. But there she was, where she'd been when I went out, in the chair, with her quilt on her lap, her boot off, her foot elevated. At the sound of my voice, she raised her face, startled. Are you all right? I said, half in the room, half out, my hand still on the doorknob. Yes, she said, surprised. I'm fine. What's the matter? Is anything wrong? I'm not sure. I got this weird call from June. I'm going to drive down there and check on her. Okay. Are you all right here? Is everything all right? Yeah, everything's fine. I'll be fine. Should I call the police? I don't know. I better go see first. Go ahead. Give me a call when you get there. I got in the SUV and drove back down the hill to the paved road. It was slow going, and even with the pavement under me, I couldn't go as fast as I wanted. I called June as I went, but there was no answer. I pushed on until her clapboard house appeared in the windshield. It was a reassuring sight at first, because it seemed undisturbed, peaceful. It was only when I got out of the SUV that I noticed the front door was slightly ajar. I was calling June's name as I took the porch stairs. I called it again as I came to the door and was calling until I stepped inside, until I saw her. It was strange. My mind had been so full of fear, yet when the nightmare came to life, I could not take it in. I could not fully comprehend it. I won't describe the way she was, the butchery. It was too much. The savage wickedness of the mind that killed her was written on her flesh in blood, her face frozen in horror of her final moment. The phone she'd called me from had fallen near her hand, and in her body, protruding from the center of her chest, was the chef's knife that was missing from the block in our kitchen. The handle the same as all the others. There was no mistaking it. It was clear at first sight that she was gone, dead. Nonetheless, I went to her. I knelt beside her, checked for a pulse. Even as I did, something awful registered in my mind. I raised my eyes to the open door of her husband's den. I could see from where I was. The gun cabinet had been broken open. Shards of glass from the door lay on the rug in front of it. I stood up. Slowly I went into the room. I could not remember how many hunting rifles there had been in there. 4, 5 more? They were all gone now. I don't know how I managed to think so clearly. It did not feel like I was thinking at all or planning at all, but I knelt down. I tried the drawer in the bottom of the cabinet. It was locked. I cleared the sharp edges of glass from the bottom of the door frame. Carefully, I reached my hand in and managed to squeeze it through the small gap between the base of the gun rack and the drawer. I turned the latch. I withdrew my hand and I slid the drawer open. Oh, with a breath of relief, I saw the handgun lying inside. A blunt 9mm automatic, a box of shells beside it. I checked the magazine. The gun was loaded. 15 shells. I stuck the pistol in my belt and stood with the box of ammo in my hand. I blinked out of a mindless daze. Melinda. I had to call Melinda. I worked my phone out of my pocket and saw at once there were no bars, no signal. How could that be? I tried to call her anyway. There was no connection. I drew the pistol out of my belt and headed for the door. My eyes darted everywhere. As I moved across the room, every corner seemed a hiding place. Every chair or table that blocked my view seemed a source of danger. It was worse when I got outside. Was there someone in June's car? In mine? What about the trees on every side of me? Was a rifle barrel trained on my heart, far from the unseen blind? Even behind the wheel, I felt exposed, vulnerable. It seemed that at any moment the window might shatter and I might be dead and Melinda unprotected. I drove quickly up the hill again, the vehicle jolting and rocking as I reached the rutted dirt road. All along the way, I scanned the forest with my eyes. Nothing there but branches waving in the wind, leaves carrying away in the wind, swirling and falling in the wind. By the time I parked in the drive, the terror inside me was as hot, as real as a fever. It drained me of strength, even as I drove me on. I kept the pistol drawn and kept my eyes moving as I climbed the porch stairs to the front door. I went inside. I saw her straight away. Melinda sat up with a loud gasp, her hand frozen high in the middle of a stitch. Oh my God, what is that? Is that a gun? Come on, we've got to get out of here, I said. My voice was low and gruff. There were windows on every side of me, open to the forest, open to the waving branches and the flying leaves and anything else that was out there. Melinda had moved. Come on, I said. June is dead. What? June was murdered. I think the children did it. What are you talking about? The child. Who was here? He took a knife. He killed her with it. Get up now, Melinda. We have to go. She tried to speak again, but I cut her off harshly. Get up! Get up! Let's go! I almost never raised my voice to her, but I did this time, and it broke through. She tossed her quilt aside. She grabbed her boot. I passed my eyes over the windowed walls, searching the outdoors. Should we pack? She said as she worked the boot on. No. Let's go. Come on. All right. Just let me. She snapped the boot shut. I went to her. I took her by the elbow with my free hand. Come on, I said. All right. Hurry, Melinda. They have rifles. What? Hurry. Finally, she stopped trying to think things through and gave herself over to me. Holding her by the arm, I led her to the door. I opened it. I searched the scene. Maybe we should call the police, she said. I ignored her. Come on. I stepped out onto the porch and drew her out behind me. I had to work to get her down the stairs in her boot. I opened the SUV door for her. "Go ahead, I can get in," she said. But I stood where I was, shielding her as best as I could with my body. When she was in, I shut the door and I raced around to the driver's side, got in behind the wheel. Melinda had her phone out. There's no signal," she said, surprised. I didn't answer. I pressed the ignition button. The SUV did not start. It did not make a sound. My stomach dropped like a hanged man. I tried again, then again, nothing. The engine was dead.
"What's wrong?"
said Melinda. She was only now beginning to piece things together. We better go back inside," I said.
"What's happening?" Her voice had risen to a high note of fear. "What is happening?
We better go back inside," I said. It was too late to leave on foot. Impossible to brave the forest in the darkness with Melinda hobbled as she was. I helped her up the stairs to the bedroom. I made her sit on the floor out of the sight line of the windows. I went down and gathered some food and some bottles of water and brought them up to where she was. I sat down beside her and waited as the daylight faded. And now the dark has come. Nothing at the window but the night and the wind. We sit side by side. I watch the door. Sometimes Melinda speaks in a whisper, venting some emotion, I guess, asking questions to which I don't know the answers, making up stories to explain things to herself. "Do you think it was the children who blew up the house?" "I don't know, Melinda." "It couldn't have been all of them, could it?" I don't know. "Maybe they were being abused or something." "Yeah, maybe." "They can't blame us for that." I don't answer. "But maybe some of them are just bad," she says. "Maybe." "How could they have cut off the Wi-Fi, the cell phones, the car so fast?" I had thought about that. I thought one of them at least must be very smart. But that was only a guess, so I say nothing. "What will we do when morning comes? I don't think I can walk all the way down the mountain." I glance over at her. Her eyes are turned up at mine, imploring. I can feel how frightened she is in my own heart. And I realize I have to say something. I have to tell her a story to carry her through. "Tomorrow is Sunday," I say. "June is a church lady. She has things she has to do there. Chores. They're written on her calendar. When she doesn't show up, they'll call her. When they can't get through, they'll check on her and find her. The deputy will know to come looking for us. We'll be all right then." It takes her a moment to understand, and then she nods. She licks her lips as the scenario settles into her mind. I can see it makes sense to her. "But what will we do if they come tonight? I mean, they're just children." I don't answer. I can't tell her the truth. The truth is, I will kill them if they come. I'll do my best anyway, every one of them. Finally, she falls quiet. She rests her head against my shoulder. I take her hand with my free hand. There's just the night now. Just the wind. The leaves chatter. The branches creak and rattle. It's hard to know what we're hearing. Which noise is which? Was that the house settling? Was that a footstep downstairs? Was that a child laughing outside under the sound of the wind? Were those voices murmuring? Hard to know. Hard to know. I hear Melinda whisper to herself, "Sunday." I clutch the pistol. I watch the door. It's going to be a long time till morning. Thank you.
All right. A little bit of Halloween flavor to that story, wasn't there? All right, I'm switching over to an Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, a story by Tyler Fike. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Tyler. The story is called Blood and Butter. A glimmering copper pot gurgled with scallop cream, a foamy cloud of sea-scented froth. Duck egg tagliatelle was thrust and hung with a steel tang fork rolled by hand into an herb-kissed barrel. Red hands stacked ingredients with surgical accuracy on polished china. Black iron pans, blue flames, white heat. Knives, knives, and more knives. Blisters burn, sweat, pressure, perfection. Into the void, the chef shouted, "Order in 5 covers, table 12, 1 agnolotti, 1 foie gras, 2 scallops." 12 cooks in unison. "Oui, chef." Hands flashed, pans were no look snatched from overhead stacks and slapped onto glowing iron rings. Cooler drawers snapped open and ingredients were extracted. No speaking. Like a hive supermind, the cooks danced within inches, microseconds of timing. A many-tentacled beast, a machine, a function. 3 Michelin stars hung on the wall. The chef towered, cooks bent and broke themselves to please the master. Geometric meat fabrications were laid into pans. Jewels of fish were handled like an infant Christ, swaddled into sizzling pools of clarified French butter. Scott Jerry worked the garnish station. Far too many cocktails that night before had his brain stiff and swollen, throbbing against the side of his skull, his concentration a mess. Blinking in and out, everything had gone wavy. Black blobs floated in the corners of his vision. His hands and feet swung heavily. He heard a strange creaking from behind, turned to look, and found nothing. The proteins were sent to the pass and placed beside the chef for his inspection. Scott was late. He had 20 seconds to catch up, maybe. He could cut a corner, save some time. On a better night, he never would have considered it. Scott only wanted to get through service back home. Home to Janelle. Clang! His pan slammed onto the stove. He got the sauce simmering, then grabbed his metal trays full of vegetables. Scott arranged them up his forearms and turned to walk them forward. He should have known better. A black cloud of terror dropped through the ceiling and swallowed him whole. "What are you doing?" snarled Chef Gehring, staring into his cook's squeaking soul. One moment Scott was a cook, part of the team. The next he was excised like a cancerous cell to be annihilated. "Walking garnish, Chef!" "No, you knob! Why are you changing my recipe?" The chef invaded Scott's station and pointed a cursed finger at a pan bubbling on the stove. Scott's hands shook under the metal trays. They were hot, not quite sizzling, but far too hot to hold for more than a few seconds. He felt the searing pain radiate from his forearms into his stomach and spine, screaming up his nerves to his dehydrated, booze-soaked brainstem. "Chef!" Gehring looked over his cook and shouted, "Did I instruct you to reduce the date puree with the veal jus?" Scott had been there before. He knew shrinking would only make it worse. He stood straight, arms burning. "No, chef." "So you're making up your own recipes?" "No, chef." "Is this your kitchen?" "No, chef." "Do you realize the only thing you've ever done worth a crap your entire life was to crawl out of that fat whore you call your mother?" "Yes, chef." "And now you're here trying to ruin my life's work?" "Yeah, I mean, no, chef." Chef Gehring squeezed in closer, his sour breath oppressing the air. "What's that?"
No, I am not trying to ruin your life's work, chef.
Then why, bellowed Gehring, is there date puree reducing with the veal jus, you little worm?
Scott wanted to drop the hot pans. Because I was late, chef.
Chef Gehring nodded. Because you were late.
Yes, chef.
And you think someone will leave you in charge of a restaurant someday?
I hope, chef. Scott wiggled inside of his white kitchen coat, the pans liquefying layers of skin by the moment.
Stand still, you little weasel.
Yes, chef.
Sweat beaded from Scott's forehead, dripped down his nose, and landed on a stalk of asparagus.
Gehring saw it and lost whatever residue of good sense he had left. He grabbed the tray of asparagus barehanded with one fell swoop and frisbee tossed it into the back wall. He grabbed the other four trays between the thick calloused fingers and dropped them onto the pass where a sous chef scurried in from behind to finish plating the dishes.
Out!
He pointed to the stairwell as he advanced on his quivering prey.
Since you don't like my recipes and you don't have the balls to keep up, you can go clean the basement. Now, go!
Scott marched down to the basement, a sweltering, unventilated, unfinished concrete and wood storage area. He fell to the floor and wept, time and space obliterating within him. There was a black fury, a crazed thrash of violence. A sack got kicked. A box was thrown. Something was twisted and torn. He screamed until his throat bled. Scott couldn't go on. Oh, he would have to call his father and admit he needed to come home. Then he took a breath. He wanted nothing more than to succeed. Failing was a part of it. Abuse was a part of it. That's how it was. Well, the old chefs got beat in France. At least they couldn't do that anymore. He had to keep trying. He had to die and be reborn. He had to eat his shame and come back tomorrow begging for more. He had to clean. A stack of linens sat askew on a wire rack, and Scott leaned down to push it straight. Something prevented it. He pulled the plastic wrap bundle of white napkins away from the rack and let it drop onto the concrete floor. Leaning down to inspect, Scott was at first perplexed as to why someone would have left their shoes there. He grabbed to pull them out, but they were solidly attached to a pair of feet. Squatting down and leaning in, he saw that the feet were attached to legs. Scott choked and fell back. He reached down and slapped one more bundle off the rack, exposing an entire female body. Her blonde ponytail dangled down between the shelf and wall, her face and head folded between her knees in a plain crash position. She was wearing her service uniform of black pencil skirt, white blouse, and black jacket. He looked at his own hands, confused. What time was it? How long had he been down there? One thought raced through his mind. Put everything back and forget it. No. Run! Scott darted for the stairs, expecting some blunt, heavy implement to crush his skull from behind. Chef! Scott burst from the stairwell, flapping in the direction of the basement. Faces peeked up, faces from every angle, faces of cooks, servers, Scott's kindergarten teachers, his babysitters, piano teachers. They were all there. A lifetime of shame and disappointment haunted him.
Jerry, said Chef Gehring, never looking up from the plate of sea bass he was leaning over. I know if you're back, that means my basement is impeccably clean and organized.
That right?
The chef cocked one corner of an evil eyeball over at the spastic cook standing at his side. No, no, chef. It's there's a person dead. A dead person in the basement. Scott stepped in closer and pointed an arm at the stairs. Chef?
Gehring never flinched. His cement jaw never moved, but somehow he said,
"What's that?"
It was getting harder to talk. Scott forgot how to make the faces and noises needed to communicate.
I was cleaning in the basement. There was a person dead.
Gehring stared down at his cook. Like an alpha gorilla being challenged by an adolescent male, he said, "Have you lost your feeble mind?"
Scott nodded. "No, no, chef. We've got to go down there."
He half turned and waved a "come along" at his chef like he was trying to get a puppy out of the street. Gehring strode straight through Scott and down to the basement.
Scott lingered at the bottom of the stairwell, nervously wringing his hands. He watched the chef march across the basement into the storage area.
"Where?" demanded the chef.
Scott bent down and pointed at the rack.
Gehring looked it over and found nothing. No linens out of place, no reams of papers mussed or jostled, and certainly no dead female body.
The chef stood up straight, hands on his hips, and said,
"What the hell is going on, Jerry? Have you had some sort of an episode?"
With red pulsing eyes and shaking fingers, Scott answered,
"No, chef. She was there, I swear."
Scott stepped into the basement and looked around. Maybe he forgot which rack it was?
Marc Philippe, the French-Canadian maitre d', appeared in the opposite side stairwell.
"Chef, Janelle is missing."
Chef Gehring turned to face Scott.
"Janelle, your girlfriend?"
Chef grinned a sick, satisfied, predatory grin.
"You finally crack, Scott. You can't hide it any longer."
At once, a flash of memory from the night before burst into Scott's mind.
Janelle broke up with him. They had a fight about his drinking, and she left crying.
Marc Philippe said to the chef,
"Janelle became upset. She asked me to be excused after you kicked Scott out of the kitchen."
Chef Gehring turned away from Scott and asked the maitre d', "And where did she go?"
Marc Philippe nodded his head, indicating the basement.
The chef spun on his heel, eyes wide with violence and pleasure. "Was she down here?" White froth climbed the chef's lip.
Scott's head swarmed and twisted. It was all a blur.
Last night, the fight, vodka, blackout, work, the basement,
the body. It felt like someone had opened a can of ginger ale in his skull.
In Scott's visual field, shadows swung in all directions. Dark blobs of death and confusion surrounded Chef Gehring and Marc Philippe.
The black climbed through Scott's periphery, closing in, suffocating him.
Faces? Sad, laughing faces. Why were they following him?
He couldn't breathe. Harder and harder to suck air into his lungs, but there was no air. It was space, a vacuum, black, gasless, nothing. He tried to talk, but couldn't move his mouth. His lips refused to separate, and he couldn't make his tongue form thoughts into speech.
Gehring leaned in closer, and Scott saw his mouth moving, but heard only burbling. That was it. The last thing Scott remembered was the chef's red, twisted, demonic face.
Through an ocean of emptiness, Scott tumbled. He cascaded through the black realms, then kaleidoscopes of color erupted in angular blobs of matter, flashes of children, playing brother, dad, a dog, a car pulling away from the driveway, his mother crying.
Scott felt his body, but struggled to find consciousness.
"Mom!"
The scream rumbled through his mind and found the matter of his lips. The sound compelled him to his body. Scott sat bolt upright and gasped for breath. It was hot, stuffy, barely any air, but Scott was alive. An empty handle of vodka lay next to him. He was on the living room floor of his apartment? Not again, he groaned. There was nobody else in the apartment. Oh, she's gone. Scott stood on wobbly legs and looked toward the door. Janelle's shoes were gone. Scott wanted to cry, but tears wouldn't come. His pain was stuck somewhere between his belly and his chest. Then the sound of a key jingling the door gave him a jump. Janelle. Janelle stepped through, glistening with sweat in her running shorts and sports bra. That's when it came. Tears exploded through both eyes, and Scott fell on her, wailing and begging and pleading for her to stay. Baby, I'm right here. Janelle stroked Scott's sweaty hairline and shushed him like a baby. Oh, I had the worst dream, he said, through crying heaves. What was it? He took a deep breath and leaned back, but couldn't look her in the eyes. I thought I lost you. Well, my friends, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Tune in again next time, would you please? Keith Tyler saying thanks so much for joining me. And make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.